such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good afternoon, and welcome to Winds of Change. This is Mary Hallin Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am privileged to be sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we have a special guest today on Winds of Change who is joining us by phone from Cincinnati, Father Matthew Gamber, who is a Jesuit priest of the Chicago province of the Society of Jesus, the same religious order that Pope Francis belongs to. Father is originally from the Chicago area here. He is from, Father, you're from Glenview, correct?
Yes, I am a native of the Archdiocese of Chicago, and I'm in what is now the Midwest province of the Jesuits. As of a week ago, 2 weeks ago, we reconfigured, and we're part of a wider Midwest province.
Okay.
So there's no more Chicago province.
Oh, gosh.
A small detail, but it's a big news for
and this
the
is
Jesuits.
Only within 2 weeks, the last 2 weeks?
Just 2 weeks ago,
Okay. Well, then I feel less bad about not knowing that. But so now it's called the Midwest province, Father? Would that be?
Yes. It's going to be called the Midwest province of the Jesuits.
Okay. Excellent. Well, Father, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the formation that the average Jesuit priest undergoes. Now, I know you have a degree in philosophy and one in theology, and then also you hold a degree in journalism from the Medill School of Journalism here at Northwestern University, which is probably the most prestigious journalism program in the United States in higher education. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what the average Jesuit priest goes through from the time he joins the society until the time he's ordained a priest?
Sure, I would be happy to. We enter the novitiate because we are a religious order.
As opposed to an archdiocesan or diocesan priest. Okay.
They would go right into a seminary and begin immediate study. So we have a Jesuit novitiate that goes for 2 years, and the Midwest novitiate is up in Minneapolis. We are there for 2 years with a lot of different experiences within it. The height of it is the 30-day silent retreat, the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola. Then, after the 2 years, if you succeed in that, you make your first vows of poverty, chastity, obedience, and then from there, you go on to further studies, usually begin philosophy studies. And that goes for 3 years. Then 3 years of teaching, either at a Jesuit high school or college for the most part. Then you would begin what would be the equivalent of major seminary studies, the final formation of studying theology for 3 years. And then you'd make your finish that, you'd be ordained to the priesthood.
Okay.
And then we have one more year after ordination training called tertianship, and that's when you go and redo all the early formation for a year, the 30-day silent retreat, and then you make your final vow. So a Jesuit makes final vows as an ordained member of the clergy and of the order. So that, in a nutshell, how it goes. For me, you mentioned my master's degree in journalism. That came after I was ordained, and there was an interest in communications work and working for the church in that regard. So I did that program at Northwestern. It was a wonderful program. I really enjoyed it. learned a lot, and from there I've done a lot of different things with media, television, radio, print, and reporting, and you know, that whole world is changing a lot. But
oh, it is. Oh, it's changed exponentially, I think, since you've graduated.
Right. I'm kind of a dinosaur, but it was a great foundational training in journalism, and just, you know, watching all the news now and how things are treated, and it's really gives you a good lens in how to critique things. You know, they're talking about today on, you know, the two-source rule now, things like that. That's just standard journalism practice, which had gone out of practice for a while.
And so, and again, for our listeners who might not be familiar with journalistic lingo, what would the two-source rule be?
Well, I'm referring to what came out, what I saw briefly this morning, CNN saying that not until they have two sources on a particular story. This is concerning the Russian matters out of D.C.
and the Trump
administration. They won't run things where they have been running just by one source. And anyone could call anyone and say something. There's
correct.
A source.
Right.
But
so,
you got to have another credible source.
Right. So there has to be a confirmation. Right.
So it can't just be anonymous sources or one leak. You know, it has to be somebody, you know, that verifies this, that also has great credibility. And they were running with things that were just one source, and that's just shoddy, bad journalism.
Right, and it allows, unfortunately, for a lot of people's personal opinions to come into story reporting when it really just should be factual reporting. So Father, you have, I'm just going to kind of cap your educational training and background here. So you've got a master's degree in philosophy, one in divinity, and then one in sacred theology, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Licentiate in sacred theology.
Correct, and then...
two-year program.
Right, which is like the church word for a master's degree, and then your journalism degree from Northwestern. So in all of those 14-some years of schooling, I know that you became a rather voracious reader, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today. You know, it's funny, every single magazine I pick up now, you know, in the months of June and July, always have the best books to read on the beach sort of section, you know, your summer reading. And so Father Matt and I met, listeners, many years ago. Father, I'm trying to think, 20 years ago at least, at a Catholic novel club that Father and I sort of co-founded here in the Chicago area when he was stationed here for the Jesuits. Father's now an associate pastor of a Jesuit parish in Cincinnati, Ohio. And so, but when he was here in Chicago, he and I were part of a really wonderful group of people who loved to read and who loved the Catholic Church and who loved novels. And we decided to make it a fiction book club because, of course, there's so much to read in terms of church history and doctrine and spirituality. But we wanted to focus on things that are sort of universally liked by readers in general, and that would be nonfiction. So Father and I, I'm trying to think how many books we probably went through together, at least 25.
Yeah, we started it, and then I had to move on, but the group continued for a number of years, and I think everyone went to one another's weddings and baptisms.
Right, and then
and now,
I think once we all started having children, we stopped reading.
Yeah, reading to their children.
Yes, exactly. So, yeah, my book club changed from me
days.
And my toddler. Yes, exactly. Well, Father, let's talk about that, because I was telling some friends I was going to be covering this topic today, and there was a lot of interest expressed by people I know, like, wow, you know, I would love to pick up something good to read, but, you know, I don't want it to be 50 Shades of Grey or something that's going to, you know, come up with something awful in the middle of it that I won't be able to get out of my head. And I think people don't realize there's a lot of really good Catholic fiction out there.
There is.
And it's not schmaltzy. I mean, I'm talking about literature, real literature. So, Father, if you had to name your top three Catholic fiction novels, what would they be?
Well, I'm a huge fan of Walker Percy and his novels. He's a Catholic convert, so any of his novels are great. Flannery O'Connor short stories and novels are excellent. But the great one that I love is Brideshead Revisited. That would be an excellent book to read in the summer. It's hefty and you know, really can dive into it. At the same time, it keeps your interest for a long time. And it's Brideshead is Evelyn Waugh, who is a male. Sounds like Evelyn, like a woman's name, but
he's British.
20th century, right. Again, convert. And Brideshead Revisited is the story of a great English household that is Catholic and all the characters in it and the various comings and goings, but especially the faith underlying it, the Marchmain family and Lord Marchmain and his wife, Lady Marchmain, and all their wild kids. And it's just a great book. It's been in, it was made in TV series in the back in the 80s, that's still pretty good. I'm told BBC just redid it.
That's correct. Yeah, there was just something in the newspapers over the weekend about the new Bryce Center visited. Correct.
I don't know if it was as good. So that one is tremendous, and it's a wonderful book. Then the other one, author 20th century Graham Greene, and his novel called The Power and the Glory is another great one about the situation of the church in Mexico during the early 20th century.
Right.
And that one, also kind of variation of it, was made into a movie a few years ago on the Cristero Revolution and the many martyrs that were there. But it's
and one of them, the very famous Jesuit priest, Father Miguel Pro, who was killed during part of that time in Mexican history.
All of these are woven in. They're novels, but they also have a lot of kind of, you know, historical basis. The other Graham Greene novel that is great is called End of the Affair.
Yeah,
which
that's one of my favorites.
But it's such a beautiful story of conversion and redemption and forgiveness and reconciliation. And so that's a great one.
Yeah, it is. That's a very gripping, and for those of you who kind of like the romance novels, it's a very gripping romance novel about a couple who is having an extramarital affair during World War II. The woman who makes, I won't want to give all the book away, but needs to make a very big sacrifice out of love for the man that she is in love with, who is not her husband. That's a very gripping, you know, love, romance, history. But as you also said, conversion, and redemption is, all woven in there in a story that's incredibly compelling. That's really one of those books when you start reading it, it's very difficult to put it down.
It is. It's just, you know, the art of it, the artistry, the literature of it, the story of it, and then at the same time, the workings of grace. That's what Graham Greene was so interested in. That's what a great, I think, when we look at Catholic novels, that they're not catechism books. They're not just, they're showing how the faith is incarnated in real life and how God is at work. His grace is always at work in lives, even if they're not always perfect, that they're being brought back to God in way, shape, or form. So those are some of the ones that first come to mind. But maybe as we talk, I'll think of some other ones. Everyone's into is Michael O'Brien he's the Canadian.
Correct. Father
Catholic
Elijah
novelist.
Was
Father
his,
Elijah's
his first book. Yes.
A lot of great things.
Yeah. I may have expressed this to you at some point, I think, because we read Father Elijah during book club. I recall that. And first of all, it's a big book. It's, you know, that's the book it's going to take you, you know, even if you're a very speedy reader, a good couple of days to a week to read because it's large. It's not a bad book, but that was not one of my favorites. I found it hit me over the head a little too much, you know, in terms of, and I guess for me, I'm always looking for, like in movies, Catholic film critic Barbara Nicolosi always makes this point. It's not enough to have a good message. The movie has to be able to stand on its own as a work of art, because if it's just this obvious sort of, you know, morality play, that's not what good art is. Has to stand. And so that's, I felt a little bit like that with Father Elijah. Perhaps I'm being unfair. I'm not really a literary critic, but I found that the message was a little too obvious in the Father Elijah series, though it's incredibly well written. I certainly would give it that. But unlike The End of the Affair with Graham Greene, you know, you can be an atheist and pick that up and I think take something away from it.
Right. I think that's one of the tests of it, that you don't really, there's not a lot of religious vocabulary or explicit religious characters. They're not novels about priests and nuns, but they're about real people and real stories. And again, like somebody at the, you know, Harvard English department could pick it up and read it and say, hey, this is phenomenal.
Yeah, this is a good
writing.
Story.
This
right.
This is a great story.
Well, when we come back from our break, Father, we'll continue this conversation on Catholic novels, what to read this summer that will both enthrall you and enlighten you and build you up. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony today on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750. WNDZ and on the
You've
World Wide Web
for the right school for your child. But what school? You've worked hard to instill right reason and the values that God has established. And yet, you might be concerned not only with your child's school's quality of education, but by what they may be teaching, maybe undermining what you have worked so hard to instill. Perhaps St. Stanislaus Kostka School could be the positive answer to your questions. Academic excellence and Christ-centered values are the hallmarks of St. Stanislaus Kostka School. To find out what may be the best opportunity for your child, visit ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org. See the videos, see the students, and see what may be the best decision you can make for your child. Contact the school online or pick up the phone and call St. Stanislaus Kostka School to arrange for a visit at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am joined today on Winds of Change by Father Matthew Gamber, who is a priest of the Society of Jesus, the commonly known as the Jesuits. He is currently serving at a parish in Cincinnati, Ohio, but is formerly assigned to the Chicago area. And Father has a very extensive background in writing and journalism, both print and visual media. And we've been talking today about a mutual interest we have, which is the great Catholic novels. And we're not talking about catechism books or books about the lives of the saints necessarily, but we're talking about great literature that also in some way embodies a truth of the Catholic faith. And Father, we were just talking about The End of the Affair by Graham Greene. And, you know, there's a wonderful list of the 100 best novels written in English that The Guardian, which is a newspaper in Britain, one of England's kind of primary intellectual newspapers, put together. And Graham Greene's book is on that list. So that was one of the things that you and I had talked about, that in order for what you and I would consider a great Catholic novel to be put into our list, it would have to also be a work of literature that could stand on its own. And certainly Graham Greene's work, which I think has been made into a couple of different times. It's been made into different, you know, versions of the movie. But also, you know, I don't know that this is necessarily a Catholic novel, but The Lord of the Flies is also on that list. And there's another novel that really
Lord does. Of the Flies or Lord of the Rings?
No, Lord of the Flies.
Tolkien is the... It's interesting how some of the great movies now are coming out of that.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That's found a whole new audience.
The most recent one is the Silence, that Martin Scorsese film.
Yes.
I did not see it, but that is a great Catholic novel written by a Japanese Catholic convert.
Well, I was going to get to that. You have jumped ahead of me, Father.
No,
that's quite all right. So Shusaku Endo, who was a Japanese Catholic,
right,
wrote the book Silence, which is based on not necessarily the characters aren't necessarily historical characters, but it is based on the Jesuit missionaries who went to Japan. Correct, Father? So you would know a little bit more. As a Jesuit, you would know a little more about this than myself.
Right, right. It's a wonderful novel. It was written only in the 1960s, but it covers the period of the Japanese evangelization, but also persecution that took place there. There would be really periods of great growth for the church and then great clamping down. You know, the emperors and the leaders were very conflicted. So this covers a period where the Jesuits were having great success, but then they were also and they were very oppressed. And could they maintain their faith? Could the people they had been evangelizing maintain their faith? And some did and some didn't for different reasons. And so it has a lot of tension within that about how do we hold fast to our faith?
Right.
The gospel yesterday was, do not be afraid, you know, and afraid of nothing, that God is with us at all times. Every hair on your head is counted, who is, and to remain loyal. And so we're not just something in the past. I mean, there's lots of our brothers and sisters in the faith struggling with that today. So,
right. And what does it, what constitutes an apostasy? Can someone force you into denying your faith? And, you know, for some of our Christian brothers and sisters in the Middle East, this is a real thing. I mean, we just had the case of those Egyptian Coptic Christians who were kidnapped on a bus on their way. They were on a religious pilgrimage, in fact, and a number of them were told to deny Christ or they would be killed, and they wouldn't deny Christ, and they were killed by their Muslim captors. And this was, what, 6 weeks ago? So these are issues that continue to present themselves to the world, and the book Silence takes that up again, setting it in Japan. When the Jesuit missionaries were there, you know, my husband lived in Japan for many years, as you know, Father, and so he was quite interested in the book, and because he knows Japanese culture so well, he was explaining to me that Japan was the only Asian country where the church could never make inroads, because, you know, the people are, stubborn is probably the wrong word, but it's a very, very different culture to evangelize in. And and I think that's why the seeds just never took root there. But there is still, I think, only 1% of the country is Christian. And of that 1% of the country, only a half of that percent is Catholic. So to me, it's absolutely minute. And it was really, again, the only country where the church was simply unable to share the gospel and have it be received. So it's interesting because Martin Scorsese took the movie, the book Silence, Shusaku Endo's novel, and made it into a movie that was released about a year ago, I think. And Barbara Nicolosi, who is a Catholic movie reviewer who lives in Hollywood and but is also a former woman religious, she's a former nun, and so she brings a very sort of Catholic lens to all of her movie reviews, and she was absolutely horrified by what Scorsese did.
Oh, she was. I did not see her review. I trust her judgment very much.
Yeah.
And I've never been wild about Scorsese since Last Temptation of the Christ.
Right. Well, I'll just share with you a tiny bit of the review. She wrote, "It's clear that Scorsese was in awe of Endo's book, and it would be hard not to be, right, because it's an incredible novel. But it is just as clear that Scorsese did not understand it. In something that is guaranteed to kill an adaptation, the whole dialogue scenes from the book are transplanted right into the movie, indicating that the filmmakers weren't sure what to do with it. They were smart enough to know that the book had something great in it, but they were not smart enough to know what that greatness was." And so she says, she goes on to say, "We can only speculate why Scorsese would be so passionate about a book he didn't really get." He didn't get it. He didn't get what... that the heart of that book is about obedience. Because remember, the young Jesuit missionaries, you know, they arrive in China first. Their beloved and esteemed former teacher, who is their superior in the order, they find out that he's apostatized. He's given up the faith. And so they determine for themselves that they're going to go to Japan and rescue him. And they do it in disobedience. Their current superior does not give them permission to go, and they go anyway. Mm-hmm. So it's about spiritual pride, and it's about the protection that religious obedience bring to those who follow it, because their superior did not want, knew what they were doing would not end well, and it didn't. So,
right. Yes. Whereas even under obedience, there's the grace of that you obey or to do things, and then you obey to omit things or to not do things quite yet. And so they took that on themselves. So they, in a way, the protective graces of obedience, which are so important to the Jesuits, were lacking there. But then the question was, did they do the right thing for the sake of the people and all those other, there's just a lot at play in that, in the book. But again, you can read it, you can take it in slowly. I think he is having to force a lot of things pretty quickly in that movie.
Right. You know what? It's funny because this is a point that I think I'd mentioned earlier in the conversation, that Barbara Nicolosi and other critics will say constantly, just because you're telling a good don't tell a good message in a bad way. Just because your message is good doesn't give you liberty to write a really bad book or produce a really bad movie. And when she cautions this constantly, when you're taking a great work like Shusaku Endo's book Silence, and you're trying to translate that into a movie, unless you get what Evelyn Waugh in Brideshead Revisited called the Catholic thing, you will not get the movie right, and you'll probably wreck it. So that's why it's so critical to have people who really have an eye for faith when they're translating these great novels into a movie, because otherwise, Barbara Nicolosi always says she has a friend who calls it, this cheesy Christian expletive, that you're putting out, because, she said it's just, you don't want these horrible, schmaltzy movies that just make the faith look unrealistic, frankly, because everyday life, everyday real world, living might include things like temptation to have an extramarital affair, or it might include, not for all of us and probably none of us in the United States, but it might include a time when you are asked, submit to us and convert or die. And, So, at any rate, let's go back.
Barbara Nicolosi is definitely a great person to be citing, and anyone listening cannot do wrong by going to her website for good reviews of movies and books and the whole contemporary Catholic art culture. I think she does a favor by holding everyone's feet to the fire and just saying, if we're going to do this, let's do it right. Otherwise, we're holding ourselves back. She's a big champion for an example of The Passion of Christ of Mel Gibson. I remember her quoting, like, she turned to Mel Gibson after seeing it and said it's a masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
This, she felt like, was great filmmaking, great storytelling, great artistry put together. And I think that, again, it stood the test of time. So,
and again, too, with that, remember, he had Mel Gibson, if the stories that I read online are correct, and the reviews of it, he had everyone on the cast and crew praying every morning, and also all the Catholics went to Mass regularly on the set.
Mass,
he had a priest,
and
he said, I made sure that everyone was going to confession regularly. He said, I did not want any spiritual interference with this movie. And he said, I wanted us all to be prepared, spiritually for what we were going to be undertaking. And so, so
it's huge. Yeah.
Huge.
James Caviezel has been out doing interviews, and he's still telling stories, 10 years later, of all the physical things that he underwent. Unbelievable.
Yes.
Unbelievable. But he even talks about how Mel Gibson tried to talk him out of it. Like, you are going into nothing but trouble by taking this. And I've kind of come to like you or something like that. And I don't want you to have to go through it. So do it, even if you do it. But then the artistry, the vocation of the great actor was like, I have to do this. So
right.
It was excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, gosh, Mary, there's so many great, great, great books and movies that are out there. But we have to, I think I was just thinking like the Catholic mindset of wanting and holding ourselves to high standards.
Correct.
I think is very important.
And again, I my sort of baseline is an atheist should be able to pick up this book and get something out of it. So, Father, when we get back from our next break, let's talk about those books that any atheist could pick up and get something out of it. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in for Father Anthony today on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
You've looked for the right school for your child. But what school? You've worked hard to instill right reason and the values that God has established. And yet, you might be concerned not only with your child's school's quality of education, but by what they may be teaching, maybe undermining what you have worked so hard to instill. Perhaps St. Stanislaus Kostka School could be the positive answer to your questions. Academic excellence and Christ-centered values are the hallmarks of St. Stanislaus Kostka School. To find out what may be the best opportunity for your child, visit ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org. See the videos, see the students, and see what may be the best decision you can make for your child. Contact the school online or pick up the phone and call St. Stanislaus Kostka School to arrange for a visit at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Do I praise, show appreciation for, and respect my spouse? Listen, we can never perfect our husband or wife by criticizing and harping on his or her faults. It's best to look in the mirror on a daily basis and work on the perpetual plank in one's own eye. See Matthew 7:4. For me, I usually find a redwood tree there. Betterment of one's spouse will chiefly be accomplished through prayer, sacrifice, and one's personal example. That's not to say that one should absolutely never charitably correct his or her spouse. There are times when this may be needed, but this approach should be very rare, and it ought to be understood that criticism is not the primary and most effective way of bettering one's spouse and marriage. Let's be patient and love, honor, and build up our spouse. I'm Jim Littleton, formingfaithfulfamilies.com.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ. And I am joined today by Jesuit Father Matthew Gamber, who is a priest in Cincinnati, Ohio, a Jesuit priest at a Jesuit parish there. But Father also holds a master's degree in journalism and communications from the very prestigious Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. And we have been talking about things, if you're looking for good books to read over the summer when you head off to the beach for 4th of July or whenever, Father and I are going to give you what we hope will be some books, maybe you've never picked them up before, that are not only wonderful Catholic novels, but they're wonderful literature combined. So, Father, one of my favorite books is Death Comes for the Archbishop by Willa Cather.
Amen.
She was simply an amazing author. And I understand she was not Catholic, correct?
No, she was Presbyterian, I believe. It's mm-hmm. interesting you bring her up because I'm calling it the Willa Cather Summer.
Okay.
Where I'm trying to read a lot of her novels.
Oh, wonderful.
But I did that because I got into a new one, which I would call a great Catholic novel, even though she wasn't Catholic. It's called Shadows on the Rock.
Okay.
And it's still in French. Willa Cather was a woman writer from the 20s to 50s, maybe. She was from Nebraska. She was never a Catholic, but she had been exposed to Catholic, and she would enter into this Catholic world and write about them. And so one in the Southwest, Death Comes to the Archbishop. Shadows on the Rock is the story set in French Canada in the late 1600s, and it's the story, it's a year in the life of Quebec from the community there. I came across it in First Things, had an article about celibacy, and the woman wrote about it and used this book as a jumping-off point because there's so much of the clergy, the religious priests, nuns, bishops that helped found French Canada. But it's about them, but it's really about this Catholic worldview and the desire to establish the church in the new world. And so Cather went up to French Canada, lived there for a number of years, and she really, really entered into it. Someone called her one of the most cultured, or if not the most cultured, writer in American 20th century history, because she could enter into another culture and bring it out.
Right.
But it's the story of a little girl and her dad, who's a pharmacist, and how she befriends everybody in the town, and then how the faith is woven in, like descriptions of midnight mass in Canada in the late, 17th century. Just beautiful scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And she weaves in scenes about the Jesuit missionaries that are coming back from their work out in the rivers and the forests of the Native American population. So Shadows on the Rock.
Kind
of the story of, Europe and versus the United States. I would love to learn more about it. So Willa Cather.
And her book Death Comes from the Archbishop, as I mentioned, is one of my, if I had to pick one of my all-time favorite Catholic novels, I think that would be it.
Why'd you love it? I'm just curious.
But the book is about, it's based on a historical figure, a French priest named Father LeMay, who was sent by his archbishop in France to essentially set up dioceses in the upper Midwest. So it is a chronicling of his journey, this Father LeMay's journey, from Ohio to New Mexico. And you know, there's actually tour companies that will take you from where he started out in Ohio to New Mexico. That's the kind of cult following, the book has. And so attached to, that was in the New York Times, Father. There was about the tour company that will take you on the Death Comes from the Archbishop tour. I don't think anybody has to die in the end, but nonetheless, they will take you on this tour. And you become so attached. She paints the picture of Father LeMay in such a paternal way and a loving way that at the end of the book, when he does die, right, because I'm not giving anything away because the book is called Death Comes for the Archbishop, you're so personally sad. You keep flipping pages back in the book going, no, I don't want him to die, so I'm just going to keep going back a couple of pages so that doesn't happen. She just completely captures, for both a woman and a non-Catholic, what the life of a missionary priest riding on horseback, trying to set up dioceses was like. And so when you say, like, her ability, first of all, as someone who was not even a Catholic, to get, as we pointed out earlier, what Evelyn Waugh called the Catholic thing. She got it.
And
she did that by, she must have been a great historian, because her novels seem to be so historically based, while still being fiction, but she must have really been a very keen student of history.
Well, as I said, this Joseph Epstein just wrote an essay, and he talked about Willa Cather as this great cultured woman because she could go in and really learn and observe and absorb so many strains from other literature to history to culture to economics to faith and theology. That book, it reminds me of a phrase that people are using around now, or just of lately, the slow work of grace. The slow work of grace, meaning that little by little, that man over the course of his life, started with nothing, but he leaves behind a diocese. He leaves behind communities. He leaves behind faith after decades and decades of hard labor and much travels. But it was a fulfilled vocation, as I was reading it, as somebody who persevered and fulfilled his vocation and could die a truly happy man.
Yeah, and she just was, I guess, Cather, was simply a master of this historical fiction genre. And for listeners who, might have had to read things like this in college and high school, she's really best known for her work, My Antonia, which is about pioneers in Nebraska, where, as Father Matthew mentioned earlier in this interview, she was from Nebraska, native of Nebraska. I think she went to the University of Nebraska as well. And but so it's her love of the way in which this country was built up and her acknowledgement and sort of homage to the Catholic priests and the Catholic Church who helped to build up that country. Because I don't think the country would exist in the way it does without the Catholic missionaries, particularly, Father, from your order, from the Jesuits, who went up into Canada and went out to minister among the Native American tribes.
She challenges kind of the received notion. I think she posits a little bit what this country would be like if the Catholic culture had become more dominant from the Canadian French perspective or from the Hispanic perspective in the Southwest. She was just so fascinated with it, you know. She really wanted to enter into it for her own sake. So I recommend her, and these two particular books are her Catholic novels that and they're just beautifully written, and she really evoked kind of the internal life, the emotional life.
Father, what was the name of the first book you mentioned of hers?
It's called Shadows on the Rock.
Shadows on the Rock. Okay. And is that available? Now, you mentioned, was it written in French? I thought, did I mishear
no,
you say
in,
that?
It's in English, but it concerns Quebec, French Canada.
Okay.
And it is still available at Barnes & Noble's, and originally written in 1931.
Okay.
But there's a new edition out on it.
Okay, terrific. All right. You know, and another book that Father, I always liked for something of a little lighter fare for people who don't want something as serious is John Power's Last Catholic in America, and his book, Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up?
You pick them up, you cannot put them down.
Yeah.
Especially for Chicago readers.
Right.
I think a lot of it's set in Chicago.
It is.
I read them years ago, but they were kind of the original genre of a very positive worldview of the Catholic Church before the Second Vatican Council, kind of the thick Catholic culture that pervaded the neighborhoods and the parishes and the families there. So, yeah, those would be a good summer reading as well. And even maybe for grandchildren or kids whose parents live that out.
Right. And, you know, what I love about it, too, now our show here, Father, broadcasts to a number of different areas, but primarily the Chicago area, is John Powers absolutely brilliantly and cohesively captures the Catholic parish life in the 1950s and 1960s in Chicago, where Chicago's one of the few cities where many people still to this day, if you ask them where they're from, they'll say, oh, well, I'm from St. Angela's. And in fact, I had a Jewish friend in college who figured out what parish he lived in just so he would know how to answer that question, because he said, I would say, you know, I'm from Uptown or I'm from Rogers Park. And people would look at him quizzically and they would say, well, what parish are you from? And he would say, I don't know, I'm Jewish. So he said, I finally figured out I was from St. Ignatius, so I could tell people that's where I lived. I'm from St. Ignatius, but I'm Jewish.
That is hilarious.
Isn't that funny? Because he said, I couldn't, you know, and he was at Loyola University. So he was at a Catholic university, and he felt very out of place not knowing what parish he was from.
Right.
So
I'm Jewish,
I think,
but I'm from St. Ignatius.
Right.
Well, I always tell people, especially I do RCIA class, like, everybody lives in a Catholic parish everywhere in the world. The whole entire world is mapped out.
Yes.
And the parish pastor is in charge of everybody in that parish area, Catholic and non-Catholic. So
right. He's
not wrong in a way. You know,
correct.
Our
yes.
ecclesiology is that we do cover everybody in that area. So that's hilarious, though. I love that.
Yeah, I love
Cincinnati is a lot like that.
Correct.
It's
still
a very strong city in that regard.
Yeah, and Cleveland is as well, and I think some sections of New York. And but that's what Powers really captures, that sense of community. And that sense of unity that the Catholic parishes brought to neighborhoods. And, you know, it's interesting. My home parish, St. Angela's on Chicago's west side, the church building and the rectory and the convent are all being demolished, in fact, this week. And it's awful. It's like a knife in my heart. I drove past. I had my husband drive me past it the other day. And I to take away that anchor in the community. And it's not just about the building. Obviously, it's about, you know, the masses that were offered there, the funerals that were said there, the baptisms that occurred, the first communions. But there was something about that church being there for the whole community and as the center of the community, you know, to grow up in a parish like that, to know that you were part of a bigger thing that was this parish. And I think that Powers really captures that kind of sentiment when people who aren't Catholic might say it's just a building, you know, it would take $1 million to repair it. Why are you so upset? But it goes, the ripple effects of just that church building being there had far more impact than just a place to pray or just a, you know, a place to get married or to have your kids baptized. The impact, I think, spiritually affected the whole neighborhood. So I'm heartbroken, you know, that it's leaving. I look at some other neighborhoods that people had written off, for example, Bucktown in Chicago, which is, I remember when St. Mary of the Angels Church in Bucktown was on the chopping block. till the priests of Opus Dei took it over.
Right.
And so they were the ones credited with saving that church, but it was going to be torn down. And now it is one of the premier destination churches in all of Chicago. And there's a waiting list to get married there and et cetera, et cetera. So when we lose those beautiful church buildings, we're not just losing history, but we're losing a whole sense of a greater community, which I think, again, to go back to the Powers book, is what he captures so well. So now, Father, I also want to talk about another favorite author of ours, which is Ron Hansen. And we're going to go into our final break. And when we come back, let's talk about Mariette and Ecstasy. Okay.
Okay. Great.
All right. Super. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just two blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org and enter into the presence of Christ.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am sitting in for Father Anthony today on Winds of Change on AM 750. And we have been discussing summer novels, things to read while you're lying on the beach that will not only entertain you, but will build up your Catholic faith and perhaps even challenge you. And Father, before we went into the break, I mentioned to you a book that we both really enjoyed reading, which was Ron Hansen's Mariette in Ecstasy. And this is really dating me, but I remember when this book came out, and apparently it just hit its 25th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. He is an amazing person. He is a professor of writing and literature at Santa Clara University. He's also an ordained deacon in the Catholic Church.
Oh, is that right?
And a native of Nebraska. He went
okay.
to Jesuit schools there and then ended up at Santa Clara, but has a real passion for literature. The last book I read of his is called Atticus, and that was a prize winner. And all his writing is great. Mariette and Ecstasy combined is a convent story of a woman having, you know, tremendous visions and trying to spiritual experiences and trying to understand them in the midst of her vocation and amidst of the community in which she's living in, and she's challenged about them and she remains true to them, and it's kind of has, I don't have an exact recall about it, but I remember being, it was one of those you couldn't put down.
Yes. And
you wanted to talk about it with other people, so it's great.
And it was one of those books, I remember the New York Times book review featured it, so did the Chicago Tribune's. It really, among secular media,
right.
had tremendous exposure, which is unusual for a book about a nun experiencing visions. Mm-hmm. I think there was a little bit of an effort, you know, to try to discredit, if you will, some of the apparitions that have that the church has considered to be valid and has considered to be authentic over the centuries. And because I believe it's been a long time since I've read Mariette in Ecstasy, but it's one of those books where you either think she's crazy or you think she's actually seeing, you know, Our Lord and Our Lady in these visions. And sometimes it's hard to tell. So it's what's really interesting is that it takes that particular sort of, I guess, hysteria, if you will, where some would write off, secular people would write off apparitions as being hysteria or wishful thinking or, you know, someone trying to create drama. And he takes that issue and he addresses it head on.
Right, right. And just very, I think he's an example of what we're talking about. Somebody with, in the hands of a great writer can take on a topic that's seemingly odd or unusually explicitly Catholic, but bring it to the wider audience, and in the same time, kind of educate, inspire, and challenge. You know, he's a writer in touch with the mystical aspect of the faith as well.
Right.
To be able to put that in print is a real challenge.
And he's a modern author, which I find
right.
you know
right.
very,
he's
so
American. He's modern. He's in our own time and place. Yeah, absolutely.
And
the other one, Convent Story, as you said, I was thinking of some of our listeners. Great book. It's a little lighter read, but is Rumor Garden in this House of Breed?
Yes.
Did you love that one?
Oh, I loved it. And, it's that's another book that was made into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very, very old. And, in fact, my husband and I rented it once, but it's the copy was so old and it was like you could barely get through the movie and understand any of the dialogue. So unfortunately, it may be one of those movies that I will never actually completely see. But
right.
But you're absolutely right. That's
the book is better than the movie, and I've seen that movie.
As it always
is. The movie
yeah.
was really good.
Yeah,
the movie was good, but that book is something that you could enter into. It's the story of a contemplative Benedictine convent in England, I believe, but this kind of really unlikely woman enters in and her own vocation, her own story, but all the sisters in the house and all that goes on there, really great, really great. Easy to read, easy
right.
reading, but you could really enter into another world. And some of these sisters, you don't want it to end. You're like, oh, what happens to her? What's
right.
she doing? Or,
so, yeah, if you love The Sound of Music, you'll love In This House
yeah,
of Breed.
Yeah, if you wanted to, like, really find out what
similar.
Was going on there.
Exactly.
Yeah, behind Sound of Music.
Right, what convent life is really like. And, Father, now another author, I'd like to give our listeners sort of a wide variety of things
sure.
to choose from, is John Hassler.
Mm.
And I know his book, some of his books were published by Loyola Press, which is, of course, a Jesuit printing house. Dear James is, I think, the Catholic novel he's best known for, correct?
Yes, he is another one. I think John would have died within the last 5-plus years, so very, very contemporary. Wrote a lot in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and he was a professor at St. John's University, I think, up in Minnesota, writer in residence there.
Right.
And I read a bunch of his books, North of Hope. He kind of does parish life in Minnesota.
Right.
And also weaves in some of the clergy and things like that. So it's Dear James is a story of a woman, kind of an exchange of letters, I think, between a priest and a woman that he knew over the years. And then
right.
I think they eventually meet and what happens. But again, he had a great like passion for humanity and for the faith and for the stories of grace. And I think that's what good Catholic literature is about.
Right. In his book, North of Hope, which might have been his last book, Father, before he died, I think. I might be right about that. I'd have to go back and check. But North of Hope, that is, interestingly enough, was the introduction to it and was edited by Amy Wellborn, who is
oh,
one
my
of my
gosh.
Yeah? Who's one of our favorite Catholic? Who we both know. So
we love Amy Wellborn.
We
she's
do.
A great writer. She doesn't do fiction as much.
Correct.
She's doing children's books, I think, which is sort of fiction. Sort of fiction. Like she's recreated maybe some stories of meeting Pope Benedict. Or
right,
like
and
that.
She did Loyal, the Kids' Book of Saints. She wrote. So I'm glad actually you brought that up. So let's talk a little bit. For those of our listeners who have teenagers or who have younger children and want them to read something that would be edifying this summer. You mentioned that Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up? It would be a good book, I think, for a tween or a teenager to read. I think that's when I read it. I might have been in high school. I think In This House of Breed, possibly a high schooler could handle, I would think, a junior or senior in high school. But let's talk about some Catholic books for younger kids. My youngest daughter made her first communion this past year, and I have to say one of the favorite books that she received was the book that Loyola Press put out, Father, on children's letters to Pope Francis and his answers.
Oh, I have not picked it up myself, but I've seen it. It's based on real live letters.
Correct.
And then illustrated with different scenes of the Pope, maybe at meeting children or things like that. So,
well, it's illustrated with the kids' own drawings. So the children write the Holy Father a letter and then draw him a picture of kind of asking their question. And then it's his answers. And my daughter absolutely loved it. I think she read the whole thing in 2 days. She sat down and read it all. And it's children from different parts of the world. And it's a question, you know, Father, you've probably heard many a child's confession. So
I'm not familiar with that. But that would be a great First Communion gift, but also a great summer reading.
Yes.
I think,
and,
for children.
Yeah, and I think that that does... also, you know, I do think my daughter said, gosh, Mom, that made me feel like I was really talking to the Pope.
Wow.
So, which I thought was terrific. Are there other Catholic children's books or novels or novels that you think would be appropriate for children that could sort of challenge them? Well, you taught at St. Ignatius High School for so many years.
Well, yeah.
If kids asked you for an example of something, hey, Father, you know, I'm going to be in the car for 10 hours with my parents. What could I read?
Good question. Off the top of my head, we had a summer reading program where we tried to get them to read different things. I would say,
I always loved the stories. I always loved the stories of the saints.
Yeah.
But I might have been weird, and you know, I might have been kind
so
of a weird
modern
kid.
Modern saints that are phenomenal, like Pier Giorgio Frassati.
Correct.
And
yes.
There's a new book about him. I think that would be
yes,
great.
Yes, there is. I just
Chiara
recommended
Badano,
that.
Chiara Badano.
Yes.
Have you heard about her?
Chiara Luce Badano.
Like,
yes, I
Chiara
have.
Chiara Badano is great. So there's all these great saints that John Paul promulgated and continued. So that's
well, you know what
a
I
Jesuit
love.
I know just did a new book on the favorite saints of Pope Francis.
Oh,
it's just
okay.
Coming out, and he kind of researched all the saints that really influenced him, and then why, and then kind of puts it together as to a better understanding of the Pope's Jesuit spirituality. A lot of these saints are Jesuit.
Mm-hmm.
But others as well. So
there's
accessible.
Yeah, there's one that was recommended to me called Macaroni Boy. I think that would be sort of for younger boys, and it's about a boy who grows up in the Depression in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. but very much infused with that sort of Catholic imagination. And then the one that I tend
to... What about the Will Wilder series that Raymond Arroyo has written?
I think
he's got two
okay.
out now, and those are supposed to be great. I gave one to a nephew. Last year, I have to follow up, did he read it and what did he think? But Raymond says he's getting great response. And again, there are stories that anyone can read, but he weaves in Catholic themes within that.
Right, right.
So Raymond Arroyo would be somebody good that's accessible. I know that I found it at a local regular bookstore here in Cincinnati.
And then, of course, you recommended the Ring Trilogy, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. And the Ring Trilogy, of course, I think there are many people who don't understand. Those are deeply Catholic novels. And
you
have a boy or a girl who likes that genre, that's very good. And then another one I find myself recommending to teenage girls is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Which is a story of an Irish Catholic family growing up in Brooklyn during the Great Depression. And,
that'd be awesome.
It's, you know, it's a heartbreaking novel, and it's Betty Smith, I believe it was the only book, you know, she was kind of a one-hit wonder in that regard. She might have had one or two other books, but nothing. It's sort of like Harper Lee with To Kill a Mockingbird. It was her magnum opus. And it's a story about a young girl. You meet her when she's about 8 or 9, named Frances Nolan, and her brother, and their father is an alcoholic and winds up dying, you know, when she's about 11, and what they have to do to survive. And just Catholic themes are, of course, obviously they were Catholic, and you know, their parish was a big part of their life. But you know, their mother, for example, on the days they had no food, they would pretend that they were stranded on a desert island and would have to wait, you know, for 24 hours for a plane to drop something off. That she would have them play games like that to get them through the days when they literally had nothing, when there was absolutely no food in the home. And so, yeah, so it's beautifully written, and it's one of
I'll tell you one of maybe like that, Anne of Green Gables.
Yes.
I just did retreat with the Sisters of Life out in New
tell
York,
us about
and
that.
They were all talking about that.
Oh, well,
that's
Father,
one of the sisters' favorite.
Well, Father,
and
I
hope
that's
getting a renaissance.
Wonderful. Well, Father, thank you so much for giving us this last hour. I hope you'll
great.
Come back and join us again, and
love
we can.
To. Thank
we'll,
you, Mary.
We'll have some of our listeners perhaps telling us what they liked about the books we recommended. This has been
wonderful.
Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now.